What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Katie Halper Show, where we are bringing you a great show, as we do every week. Before we bring on our guests or intro our guests, I just want to remind people that the way you can show your respect for The Katie Halper Show, or you don't have to respect The Katie Halper Show or me, show your respect for the topics that we talk about, the people that we bring on the show. A way you can do that for free is by giving it a like, a thumbs up. Very easy. What do they say? It's not a heavy lift. It's a light lift. And you're making the world a better place just by doing that because it helps the algorithm. And then it helps the world because, again, we do bring really important guests onto the show. And who knew that you could help the world with just a click of a button that is a thumbs up? But really, it does help with the algorithm. And we need to make sure that we are getting ahead of shows like Pod Save America and Pod Save the World and all that stuff. So an easy, really easy way to do that, again, is just by hitting the like. Also, please do subscribe. We are past 350,000 subscribers, which is great. And if you can support the show on Patreon, we really could not do the show without you. I know it sounds really corny, but it is true. We couldn't do the show without you. So you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, and you get to make this show happen. And you also, at the $5 a month level, you get bonus content, additional interviews, early access. So this week, for instance, you will get a full interview with Nick Bryant, who is the person who published Jeffrey Epstein's Black Book with Gawker. So I talked to Nick about Jeffrey Epstein, about a really weird thing that Mike Johnson does with his son. I won't give it away, but it's pretty weird. And also some controversy that he has with some people on the internet. So again, that's at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Now, during the second half of the show, we're going to be talking to journalist Taylor Lorenz, who has a bombshell of a story about basically dark money groups that are paying Demfluencers, I believe they're called. So influencers who want to support the Democratic Party. And honestly, what's fascinating about that story is not just the story itself, but the response to the story is kind of part of the story because it's a very meta reaction because people are doubling down. People are furious with Taylor Lorenz. They are lying about her. They are lying about what she says. And so that'll be fun. We'll get to talk about that with Taylor. We'll get to watch some clips of people like David Pakman, who's one of the people who's involved with this chorus organization. But the first half of the show brings us one of our faves, really one of the best guests that we have on the Katie Halper Show. That's why we have him on so frequently. He's a regular fan fave. His name is Craig McKeiber. He's an American, former United Nations human rights official and a specialist in international human rights law, policy, and methodology. And as you guys know, on October 28th, 2023, he famously stepped down as the director of the New York Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. And in his final letter to High Commissioner, he harshly criticized the organization's response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza and called Israel's military intervention a textbook genocide and accused the UN of failing to act. And he's going to talk to us today about his latest piece, Mondo Weiss, which actually provides a way, perhaps, for the UN to stop Israel from doing what it's doing. Welcome, Craig.
Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Thanks so much for coming. And thank you for everything that you do. And most recently, that means thank you for writing this really great piece at Mondo Weiss, How the UN Could Act Today to Stop the Genocide in Palestine. So walk people through how the UN could do this and what this little used UN mechanism is that they could use.
Yeah, right. So I think everybody is aware by now that essentially all international institutions have failed utterly to take the action that would be necessary to put an end to this 23 months of live stream genocide that we've been witnessing in Palestine. And it's normal that folks are saying, you know, what happened to all these international laws, all these international institutions, everything that was supposed to be built up since the Second World War to say never again and to actually intervene? What happened to the responsibility to protect? What happened to international human rights? And they're right to ask that question. The problem is people often don't dig much deeper than that. And so the quick answer is, well, the U.S., which is a permanent member of the U.N. Security Council, which is the only enforcement body in the international system, vetoes every attempt to do something meaningful, and therefore there's nothing that can be done. The first half of that is true. The U.S., as a co-perpetrator of the genocide, and as a permanent member, continuously uses its veto in order to make sure that the genocide continues. But there are a lot of countries out there that like to hide behind that veto, right? They like to say, well, you know, we tried, but the U.S. vetoed it. There's nothing we can do. And what my piece says is there is something they can do. There are a few things that they could do. One is that the obligations that they have under existing human rights treaties actually oblige them to take action, to intervene if they're in a position to do so, to help to stop the genocide, to break the siege, to bring in humanitarian aid, to protect civilians, and so on. So, for example, the Geneva Conventions are treaties that not only force countries to respect the rules that are in the Geneva Conventions, but they're also obliged to, quote, ensure respect, which means they have to take action when other countries are violating them to step in. None have done that. The same is true of the Genocide Convention and of other international instruments. So any country or group of countries at this moment or any time in the past 2 years could have acted within certain parameters to try to do something. Now, with the exception of, you know, Ansar Allah, Yemen, no country has done so in a meaningful way. You can argue that there were diplomatic and legal measures taken, South Africa's landmark genocide case in the World Court and so on, but none have actually deployed their navies or their armies or their logistical capacities. And that's because countries really like to have diplomatic legal cover. They like to have an international mandate to take action. And when they see that the Security Council won't give it to them, they just throw up their arms. But there is another mechanism, Katie. It's called Uniting for Peace, which is the name of a resolution that was adopted in the General Assembly in 1950 at the height of the Cold War that allows countries to circumvent a veto in the Security Council and to take practical action on the ground. Now, that resolution, Uniting for Peace, has been used many times. But it's even been used several times during the current upsurge in genocide in Gaza. But it's been used for the most part only to make some general calls for a ceasefire, for humanitarian aid and so on. But no practical measures have been adopted. And there is a precedent here that could be applied under Uniting for Peace with a modicum of political will. And this is what it is. In 1956, the British and the French and the Israelis were attacking the Sinai, and you know, oddly, the U.S. was opposed to that intervention. Folks will forget, but of course, the British and the French were not going to allow action to stop it in the Security Council because they too have vetoes. And so, what happened was this resolution was adopted with a supermajority in the General Assembly that said, when the Security Council can't act, the General Assembly, which is a democratic body where every state has one vote, 193 countries, there's no veto, the General Assembly can act in place of the Security Council with enhanced powers, not the same powers as the Security Council. There are limitations, but with enhanced powers. And what they did in 1956 was they mandated a UN emergency force called UNEF, the UN Emergency Force, and actually deployed troops to the Sinai. And they did that because They got a two-thirds majority, which is required for this mechanism, in the General Assembly, and then got countries to, beginning with the Canadians, to provide forces to actually launch this this intervention. They didn't need so-called Chapter 7, which is the enforcement power of the Security Council, because they got the consent of Egypt to deploy their troops to the Sinai. Now, in Palestine, we have a very clear case, a very clear opportunity to do the same thing, because just last year in 2024, the International Court of Justice made very clear that Israel has no sovereignty over Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, that it has no authority in those territories, it has no rights in those territories, not even to say yes or no. It doesn't have any legal standing to pronounce on whether or not a force should be deployed. The only entity that would have legal standing would be the state of Palestine, as represented by the observer mission of Palestine to the UN, which has itself requested intervention already. What that means, in a nutshell, is that because Palestine has requested it, because Israel has no rights in the territories to say yes or no, because there is the 1956 precedent, and because the General Assembly has the power to do it under the Uniting for Peace resolution, the UN today could deploy a UN protection force to Palestine with a specific mandate to protect civilians, to deliver humanitarian aid, to preserve evidence of Israeli war crimes, and to begin the process of recovery and reconstruction. And there's nothing legally that Israel could say. Now, I'm going to stop, but I first want to say, of course, it is politically challenging, because you can be sure that the United States and the Israelis and maybe some of their other complicit allies will do everything in their power to block the resolution by threats and bribery to small countries so that they don't vote in favor of it, and potentially to obstruct the mission. But there have been a number of resolutions on Palestine where a supermajority has been gained, more than two-thirds of the General Assembly. There's no reason to believe that you couldn't achieve it now. And the beauty of this is that every country effectively, under the glare of public scrutiny, would have to vote yes or no for a protection force for a people that's undergoing genocide. They wouldn't be able to hide behind the U.S. veto or the dark corridors of Turtle Bay at the U.N. They would be forced to say on the record that they support it or they don't support it. And I think with that kind of political pressure, there's a decent chance, at least, that a resolution like that could be passed.
Okay, so walk us through what this would look like. What it would look like within the UN, and then what it would look like on the ground.
So in the UN, we've reached a particular moment here. You know, on roughly the 18th of September, a deadline is going to expire, which was given to Israel by the General Assembly a year ago, in which they said, you have to end the occupation, because the World Court has said you have to end the occupation entirely. And you have to implement the provisional orders of the World Court on the genocide case as well. If this is not all done, if you don't comply within 1 year, which is going to, the 1 year is going to be up in a couple of weeks, then additional measures will be adopted. And in the UN, what's happening is that Israel's principally Western allies, as well as the Saudis and a few others, are scurrying to try to shift the focus away from Israeli accountability and away from resolutions, for example, in the General Assembly under Uniting for Peace, that could call for economic sanctions, a military embargo, the stripping of Israel of its UN General Assembly credentials, the reactivation of the anti-apartheid mechanisms, potentially the establishment of a criminal tribunal for Israel, and the mandating of a UN protection force for Palestine. What these countries that are working with Israel are trying to do is to shift it away and say, let's not do that. Let's focus everybody on a handful of states recognizing the state of Palestine and getting back into a kind of Oslo process, a kind of Oslo 2.0, a two-state solution, you know, a Palestinian Bantustan somewhere down the road. But let's normalize Israel's status even as it perpetrates a genocide in Palestine. And that's the tug of war that's going on now in international diplomacy and in the UN. If people focused on justice, international law, accountability prevail, then you could have what I have been describing, all of those elements. If they don't, you will end up with basically measures that are designed to give Israel once again a cloak of normalization, as I say, during or in the wake of its genocide in Palestine. So it comes up in the end to the political will of the majority of member states to stand on principle here. Now, as I said, the state of Palestine has already requested these measures, and in particular, the deploying of a UN protection force. It has been also called for by organized Palestinian civil society from organizations across Palestine, and their lead coordination mechanism called PINGO, P-N-G-O, has called for it. Many voices in Gaza have appealed and begged for that kind of intervention. It has been supported by a coalition of civil society actors across borders and across the world. It's getting a lot of attention now. But the fact that it's getting a lot of attention is also increasing the pushback that's happening in the UN to prevent it from happening. If we get there, what will happen is, you know, there are two possible channels. One is they first try to get it through the Security Council. The Americans veto it. That's one scenario. And then it goes to the General Assembly under Uniting for Peace, where it could pass, even though the U.S. in particular would be mobilized to try to prevent it from passing. But it still could pass. There's another scenario where the French and the Americans enter into a scheme together, and they pass a watered-down resolution in the Security Council to prevent these more meaningful things from happening in the General Assembly. And so the French and the Saudis have been pushing a so-called stabilization force. But if you look at the details of that stabilization force, you see it's not really focused on the protection of Palestinian civilians from the Israeli perpetrators, but it's more focused on trying to normalize the situation, to return to the status quo before October 2023 with the caging of the Palestinian people, to normalize Israel again in spite of its many, many crimes of the last 2 years. Hopefully that will not be what comes out of this, but there's a very big push to make that be the story. And then, you know, there's a third possibility, which it goes to the GA under Uniting for Peace, and the Americans and the Israelis manage to threaten, bribe. You know, the Americans are not beyond threatening small countries that are struggling with sanctions, with tariffs, with God knows what. So what will make the difference here is the degree to which there is a bright public light and a powerful public demand from civil society across the world to say, hold the line for Palestine. Don't miss this opportunity, because we've been watching all of these countries for 2 years standing idly by while this genocide carries on day after day, month after month.
Right. You know, obviously, one of the few entities to actually do something, you know, to actually carry out what you rightly describe, right, as their obligation in terms of what you're supposed to do in the face of genocide has been Ansar Allah in Yemen. And they've actually been attempting to fulfill its duty under international law to end the genocide. And as a result, Israel has been targeting Ansar Allah's leaders and Yemeni infrastructure. And here's a video with a dubbed voiceover of Yemen's Minister of Information responding to the assassinations, followed by a voiceover of Prime Minister Netanyahu saying Israel will continue its aggression. So let's take a listen to this video.
to those inside and abroad is a message of challenge and steadfastness, and that we are standing side by side with our revolutionary and political leadership. We present a convoy of martyrs to join the ranks of the martyrs of the leadership of the government of change and construction. Many have gone and many will come. We will make sacrifices for the sake of the cause, for the sake of the challenge, for the sake of the steadfastness with our brothers in the Gaza Strip.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the retaliation campaign against the Houthis. He addressed the Israeli Security Cabinet on Sunday.
The Houthi terror regime is learning the hard way that it is paying and will continue to pay a very heavy price for its aggression against the state of Israel. Whoever attacks us, we attack them. Whoever plans to attack us, we attack them. I believe the entire region is learning about the strength and determination of the state of Israel.
So what is your response to what Yemen is doing, what is being done to Yemen in response, and also, I guess, the response or lack thereof from the rest of the world to Israel's illegal response to Yemen?
Entirely illegal response to Yemen because, I mean, both, for example, the attacks that took place on Yemen in previous months, and by the way, attacks that were specifically because Yemen was carrying out an embargo preventing ships from resupplying a regime perpetrating genocide, that is Israel, as you say, in implementing its international responsibilities in doing so. And this most recent attack assassinating effectively the head of government and much of the cabinet. These are crimes under international law. They're violations, they're grave breaches of international humanitarian law. They are also violations of international human rights law because they are extrajudicial executions. And, you know, we've heard a lot of Israel apologists and the Hasbara proxies out there trying to say, well, it wasn't the legitimate government of Yemen. It's completely irrelevant. First of all, the Ansar Allah government, whether you recognize it or not, controls 80% of the population of Yemen. It controls the biggest city, the capital city of Sana'a. It is the de facto authority for most of the country. Secondly, these people who were targeted are political authorities. They are not military personnel. They are off bounds. You can't just go assassinating the political leaders like this. This is a violation of international law. Your non-recognition of political authorities, if you say they're not the legitimate government, the other guys are, that does not render them legitimate targets under international law. You're still committing a crime, whether you recognize that government or not. And here's the big thing, which really it amazes me watching corporate media and listening to some of the spokespersons from the government and so on. They think that uttering the word terrorist is a magic word that erases international law and basic principles of mortality. It does
Freudian
not.
Freudian slip with mortality, right?
Both. It does not. You know, just saying, well, they are terrorists and we get to do whatever we want. There's no such thing in international humanitarian law. The distinction is between combatants and non-combatants. This was also an act of aggression under the UN Charter. And as such is a crime as well, what has been called the supreme international crime of aggression. So this is lawlessness. They do it because they can do it, because they act with impunity. That impunity guaranteed by the government of the United States, paid for with the tax dollars of many people within the range of our voice right now. It is a crime, and it's a product of the complicity of the government of the United States.
It's also rich watching people who are so fond of breaking international humanitarian law talk about technicalities. Well, they're not technically the recognized government. I mean, give me a break, like pick a lane. Either you recognize these laws or you don't. And we see them not recognize them and violate them every time. Like you say, they say something like, well, that person's a terrorist. And what's so rich is that you see like the double lie. I believe you said this, you wrote an article, right, about the double lie of self-defense. And so it's like They're lying about what they're doing. But then the bigger lie is that they're not allowed to do that anyway. Like, even if there were a Hamas person in that hospital bed, which they claim without any evidence, even if that were the case, it wouldn't be legal. So what's your response to those points?
Yeah, absolutely right. Both the justification is a false justification, and it's not a justification that the law doesn't allow you to do that just by using that magic word of, well, they were terrorists or whatever is the word you want to attach to them. So, yeah, this is, we're living in an age of absolute lawlessness. But I think it is important for people to be aware, you know, in the battle for international legitimacy, that there is this thing called international law, that the rules are there. And don't be fooled because you're hearing it on cable news or from some spokesperson at the U.S. State Department that they say a terrorist or all of these other sorts of, you know, or self-defense. You know, they just rattle off these words that are just a part of the bigger lie,
right,
which is aggression and hegemony in the region.
I'm always amazed, and maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm amazed that people who I consider to be not totally idiotic will praise, for instance, what Israel did with the pagers in Lebanon. And we had you on right when that happened. Actually, you and Rania both came on the show. But I bring it up because Leon Panetta, right? Former head of the CIA, another Freudian slip, given how in lockstep they are. Former head of, and of course, you've come on the show and we've talked about how horrible Dana Bash and Jake Tapper are. So as an intentional subconscious callback, but, you know, former CIA director Leon Panetta calls it terrorism, what Israel did. And yet people are so trained to accept everything that Israel does as legal that they kind of ignore the fact that what they did themselves was terrorism.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we've seen this story before. What they tried to do, after that, you know, quintessential transnational terrorism attack on Lebanon with booby-trapped pagers in violation of a raft of international laws, their answer was, they committed an act of terrorism. Their justification was, we were killing terrorists. So you claim that your victims are terrorists, and that's exactly what they're doing in the case of Yemen as well. So they carry out this act of what would be quintessential terrorism, and then they justify it by saying the people that we killed were terrorists. Well, they're not. They may be terrorists to you because your enemy is always the terrorist, right? I mean, this is the problem with the whole concept of terrorism, which is not defined in international law, by the way, precisely because it is effectively a political concept. It is not a legal concept internationally. It's in national laws, there are lots of counterterrorism laws and so on. And we all know what that has led to, which is massive repression, widespread surveillance, the erosion of civil liberties, renditions, kidnappings, torture, you know, all sorts of things. You just utter that magic word terrorism and the law dissolves away. And that's bad enough that you've got political authorities and governments that are willing to do that. But the fact that media corporations then adopt the same narrative in the process, justify lawlessness and erode the human rights of all of us, wherever we're living, that makes it a double sin, I think.
Well, another body that kind of in some ways like Ansar Allah is trying to do the right thing when the rest of the world is not doing the right thing and is doing the opposite, which is being either silent or complicit in genocide. There is the another Gaza Freedom Flotilla is happening right now as we speak. They are trying to break the siege and blockade of Gaza, and it's the Global Samud Flotilla, and it's they're expecting it to be 50 plus boats strong. What is the significance, in your opinion, of this kind of historic attempt?
Well, I think it's truly inspiring. I've said this is a light in the darkness, so powerfully that you have, you know, a large number of boats, a larger number of people, humanitarian minded people, some of them very prominent people, other just absolutely committed activists, doctors, humanitarians, and others, who have said we are not going to wait for governments and international institutions to act. We have a moral duty, all of us, to respond, even if it means putting my own comfort, my own safety, my own health, potentially my own life and freedom on the line. We are going to do this, and we're going to keep doing it until this siege has been, this unlawful siege of Gaza has been broken. And they're doing it knowing that Israel, as a lawless regime, has bombed some of the ships out of the water in the past. It has boarded one and murdered 10 of the humanitarians who are on board in another case. It has pirated and seized several others. And now it is threatening to attack this flotilla of humanitarians trying to bring baby formula to starving children in a genocide in Gaza. It is threatening to attack this flotilla, to arrest all of the humanitarians on board the ships, to put them in what they call the terrorist jails, to lock them up in the same harsh conditions that they use for others that they don't like, Palestinians principally, to seize their boats and make them the property of Israel to be used for policing purposes. Whoever heard of a Zionist actually taking something that's not theirs and claiming it as their? So all of this, and yet they sail on. They sail on because they know it's the right thing to do. And Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur, has said, why isn't there at least one country with a navy in the Mediterranean escorting those boats? Because every state has an obligation to take these kinds of measures, to break the siege, to end the genocide, to protect the civilians of Gaza. But these folks aren't waiting. They're doing it. They know the historic moment in which we're living, and they refuse to just sit idly by while it happens. I think all eyes need to be on the flotilla, as they have in the past, and we all need to be mobilizing, pressuring for other countries to step up and to provide the defense of these. If we were to have a successful intervention through Uniting for Peace or even just the mobilization of one or two navies, we could break the siege. You know, we know that Israel doesn't hesitate to murder Palestinians on a daily basis. We know that Israel has not hesitated to murder UN workers in their hundreds just in the course of the last 2 months. We know that Israel has murdered UN peacekeepers in UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, for example. But imagine a multinational force drawn from countries in Europe, Latin America, Africa, Asia, and so on, sailing in entirely unarmed in a humanitarian, not unarmed, let me take that back. The flotilla is unarmed, right. But to have an intervention with a UN mandate, it could be an armed force sailing in with the specific international mandate to go in and protect civilians and feed them and so on. It changes a bit the calculus,
right.
The political calculus from Israel ratchets up the pressure. And, you know, as I've said before, it's not guaranteed to be successful. None of this is guaranteed to be successful. And the obstacles are enormous. And we may fail. But what we know for sure is if we don't try, we have already failed. And so all of these initiatives are about deploying whatever tools we have in order to change the situation on the ground.
Right. Well, you know, this is actually, speaking of Israel's history of killing people on these boats, which they did, of course, in 2010. This is kind of exciting. Here's video of a dock worker in Italy declaring that if they lose contact with the fleet, meaning, you know, if the fleet is intercepted or if they're attacked by Israel, they will shut down the ports across Europe. Let's take a listen. I want this to be clear to everyone, really to everyone. Around mid-September, these boats will arrive near the coast of Gaza and close to the critical zone. If we lose contact with our boats, with our comrades, even for just 20 minutes, we will shut down all of Europe. I have written it down so I won't forget it. Together with our union, together with all the dock workers who stand with us, together with the whole city of Genoa, from this region, 13 to 14,000 containers go to Israel every year. Not a single nail will leave anymore. We will launch the international strike. We will block the ports, block the schools, block everything. Our young women and men must come back without a scratch. And all this cargo, which belongs to the people, and this is going to the people, it must reach its destination down to the very last box. I certainly hope that happens. That would be great if they actually did shut down the ports. Do you have any insights into what's happening right now with the flotilla and what the dock workers are doing?
Yeah, so encouraging to watch that, Katie. I mean, what you see happening all around the world is, so what we know from massive mobilizations, from opinion polls, from all sources of information is that the entire world is opposed to this genocide and is standing with Palestine. We're also seeing at the same time in a great mask-off moment that most governments of the West are aligned with the genocide, are complicit in the genocide, and are completely in opposition to their own people. Even right here in the United States, where you have a complete blackout of the truth in corporate media and the most complicit government of all governments in the world, the people of this country overwhelmingly are opposed to Israel, to its genocide, supportive of the Palestinian people, demanding some kind of intervention. So you have labor unions and churches and synagogues and social organizations and movements and just ordinary folks all around the world who are absolutely infuriated and horrified by what we're all being forced to witness and furious with their own governments and then using whatever power they have. If you are in a labor union, if you have a boat, if you have a sign, whatever you have, using it to oppose the horror of this genocide. And it is making a difference. We are seeing European governments too slowly and too little changing their public tone. You know, they started off in the beginning simply cheering the genocide and repeating this mantra that Israel has a right to defend itself. No, it doesn't, by the way, in these circumstances. And now they are tripping over themselves, trying to preserve some modicum of legitimacy in the long term. Either historically or politically, by changing their language. This isn't because they've had an epiphany. This isn't because they suddenly have found morality in the middle of the night. They're feeling the political pressure from all of us, from those labor unions, from those flotillas, from those demonstrations, from those students in their encampments, from independent media voices like yours, Katie. So that means that, you know, this is the moment to raise our voices louder, to think creatively about what we can do to bring pressure to bear, and to use that South Africa model that we always talk about. Isolate the regime, protest and dissent against our own complicit governments, and where we can help, you know, mobilize to help in some practical way, not just with our words.
Great. A couple more questions that I have for you. One is, speaking of the sea, flotillas and aquatic activity, I guess, today Trump bombed a ship in the South Caribbean that he said was carrying drugs. This comes after he sent troops to the Caribbean to fight the narco-terrorism, as described by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, coming from Venezuela and connected to its president, Nicolas Maduro. And so here's Trump announcing the strike from an event at the Oval Office. Let's take a look, and then I want to get your reaction.
When you leave the room, you'll see that we just, over the last few minutes, literally shot out a boat, a drug-carrying boat, a lot of drugs in that boat. And you'll be seeing that, and you'll be reading about that. It just happened moments ago, and our great general, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's been so incredible, including what took place in Iran, knocking out potential nuclear power for a long time to come. I think within a month they would have had it if we didn't do what we did. But he gave us a little bit of a briefing, and you'll see. And there's more where that came from. We have a lot of drugs pouring into our country, coming in for a long time. And we just, these came out of Venezuela and coming out very heavily from Venezuela. A lot of things are coming out of Venezuela. So we took it out, and you'll get to see that after this meeting is over.
So what's your response to this, to these types of actions?
You know, this is so ironic. You know, the position of this government has been that the Houthis, Ansar Allah, intervening to stop ships that are fueling a genocide, right? That intervention is unlawful and unacceptable, even if it's happening in the territorial waters off the coast of Yemen itself. That's unacceptable. What he's saying there, and we have to wait to see, you know, I don't know anything about this, what the boat was, where the boat was flagged, whether it was a vote of the government or a private ship, whether it was or was not drug smuggling. We don't know that. All we know are the claims of the U.S. administration, which, by the way, have deployed its Navy off the coast of Venezuela outside of its own territorial waters. Some days ago, in a very provocative act, clearly designed to ratchet up pressure on the government of Venezuela, nothing to do with Trinidad Aragua or any of these things they say. But, you know, so first, what is the U.S. Navy doing in the Southern Caribbean off the coast of Venezuela, somebody else's territory? What is it doing there? It's not supposed to be there. You know, there's something called the, and this is not my area of expertise, but there's something called the Convention on the Law of the Sea that governs what is lawful in these circumstances. The U.S. refuses to ratify the Convention on the Law of the Sea, the main law of the sea, and it just acts lawlessly, as I think we have just seen here. Now, there are cases I know that, for example, if you're in hot pursuit, if a vessel commits a crime in your territorial waters and you're chasing it, then maybe outside of your territorial waters, you could intervene in this way. That's clearly not the case. They sailed off the coast of Venezuela to attack this ship. So that's questionable at best. Secondly, if this is a ship that was flagged from another country, that's an act of aggression, potentially. So another crime being perpetrated here. This is not maritime law enforcement in your own territorial waters where you're allowed to do certain things. You know, as it was described there, this is something quite different. But ultimately, what strikes me when I hear that is that the U.S. government thinks they can sail into the, you know, outside of their own territorial waters, attack a foreign flagged ship, if that turns out to be the case. And yet it can also bomb those who are doing maritime law enforcement off their own coast to stop a genocide. This is pretty outrageous stuff. But, you know, I'm willing to wait and listen to the details since this has just happened and I haven't had a chance to read about it. But just on its face, it looks pretty awful from a legal perspective and arguably from a moral perspective.
Yeah. And this, of course, is, what does he call himself? The president of peace, right? This is the president of peace.
Yeah. I'm sure the Nobel committee is listening very carefully as he supports a genocide and bombing Iran and attacking ships off the coast of Venezuela. This is a real man of peace.
Well, Witkoff really wants him to do that. He told the Nobel committee that he's hoping they do the right thing, which, to be fair, I mean, given that Kissinger got one, maybe he would be in good company. Final question from me to you, Craig. It's kind of a combo question. So two things that I think are related, which is that on Monday, the International Association of Genocide Scholars officially passed a resolution declaring that Israel is committing genocide. I wanted your comment on that. And also, this is fascinating. So the vice president of the International Court of Justice, Julia Sabotinde, I believe you talked about this. It was either you or Norman Finkelstein talked about this on this show. She recently said, "The Lord is counting on me to stand on the side of Israel. The whole world was against Israel, including my country." So people are demanding her removal from the court based on her obviously religiously motivated views. So what are your thoughts on that? And do you think she will be forced to resign, will be removed? And also, to be fair, how inconsistent is this with other leaders? I mean, the things that, you know, you have Netanyahu talking about Amalek. I guess, to be fair, he's not a jurist. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, she's the vice president of the World Court, and she is participating in a genocide case against Israel. And she has publicly stated that she sees her responsibility, her duty to God, to defend Israel. She thinks the modern state of Israel is the Israel of the Bible, and God has commanded her to protect Israel. And she said this publicly while this case is going on, which came as a surprise to, I think, very few people. If you follow the court and you read her sole dissent in the genocide case on the provisional measures, where even the Israeli judge voted with the majority against Israel, but she did not, with no legal basis at all. As you know, the opinion that she wrote, as people have reported, is largely plagiarized, came out of pro-Israel lobby sources, proxy sources, and so on. No reflection of international law at all, just a kind of prejudice. And she has now stated publicly the purpose for that. And the statute of the court and the rules of the court provide that she should have recused herself. She should not have participated in the case, which she has done to try to run cover for Israel. But now, if the court wants to be viewed as legitimate at all, it only has two options. And I think the judges, including the president of the court, will be very cognizant of this reality now. Either she can be removed from the case, which would be the minimum, or, which I think is what I think should happen, she should be removed from the court. She has damaged the reputation of the court, she has discredited herself, and she has called into question the proceedings that have taken place so far while she was vice president. I can say we dodged a bullet, because when she was vice president and the previous president stepped down to return to Lebanon, she was the acting president. And a lot of the folks were very afraid that she would, just because of protocol, just be made the president of the court. Luckily, that did not happen. She still has influence. She should, as a minimum, be removed from the case. But I think at this point, with that kind of public statement, making it very clear, she has announced her prejudice and her commitment to not holding Israel accountable under international law. She needs to be removed altogether from the court. She needs to be removed. She needs to leave in shame.
Yeah. It's kind of a great metaphor for the impunity faced by Israel, I guess, and its defenders, even someone who sits on a court, the fact that she would say something like that publicly. And your thoughts on this resolution? I mean, it's a little late, right? This has been, people like you have been calling it a genocide from the beginning, but is there anything positive that comes from this resolution from scholars?
This is the preeminent association of genocide scholars, the fact that they have overwhelmingly declared that this is the case. It has institutional value. It is a surprise to no one. It is very late. As you know, my letter was in October of 2023. By then, it was already evident what was happening. It only took a couple of months for South Africa to bring a case in the International Court of Justice for genocide against Israel. Everyone who specializes in this area, either international law or genocide scholars, every major international human rights organization, from Amnesty to Human Rights Watch, every major Palestinian human rights organization, from Al-Haq to the Palestinian Center, every major Israeli human rights organization, from B'Tselem to Physicians for Human Rights, have long since all declared the very obvious fact that this is a genocide, that it aligns 100% with the definition in the Genocide Convention, and that it has, as we have discussed before, this very unique characteristic of being the first genocide that any of us have studied, where the intent, the genocidal intent of the perpetrators, is repeatedly declared out loud in the glare of the public. By Israeli leaders, including the president, the prime minister, seven cabinet ministers, senior military officials, and all the way down the line. You know, you have to be blind or willfully ignorant to not have known already that this was a genocide. I understand they represent an association, which is an institution, which it takes longer to go through the various steps. But it's very, very late in the game. But there is no credible voice left that has not already now come to the conclusion that we are witnessing a genocide, and that that obliges, under international law and under any notion of morality, that obliges every state, every international institution, and all of us to do whatever we can to stop that genocide, to hold the perpetrators accountable, to provide redress for the survivors, and in my view, to begin the process of isolating and ultimately dismantling the genocidal regime.
Thank you so much. Any final words on anything else that you want to make sure we talk about?
Not at all. Great to see you again, Katie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all that you do. Thank you for writing what you write, saying what you say, and we will see you shortly, I'm sure, as one of our regulars.
See you soon.
Thanks, Greg. All righty. So, by the way, we are about to bring on our next guest. That was great. Always love talking to Craig. So smart, and really does give me hope that there are people like him in the world. Maybe gives me hope for international law being a thing, not totally toothless. We'll have to see. I'm about to bring on Taylor Lorenz. But before we do that, we are going to play a very quick preview of our Patreon-only interview with journalist Nick Bryant. And again, if you want to see this in full, you can find it at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. I talked to Nick about Epstein, about Mike Johnson, and about a little beef he has with Michael Tracy. Sit back and enjoy. And then we will bring on Taylor Lorenz, who is going to be talking about this amazing and insane story about Democratic influencers that now she has to do an update to the story because there's a whole other story in the reactions from these people to her story. Okay. See you in a second.
Left spaces, not just left spaces, actually, I would say like alt media, alternative media, is that Jeffrey Epstein was intelligence and specifically involved with Mossad and Israeli intelligence gathering. What is your response to that? And have you found any evidence to support or refute these claims?
Alexander Acosta was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida. And he was asked, he was being vetted by the Trump administration. He'd become, during the first Trump administration, he'd become his Secretary of Labor. And he was asked, why did you go so light on Jeffrey Epstein? And he said, I was told it was intelligence and I had to back off. And then this came out that he had gone light and then he was kind of just expunged from the Trump administration. But he did give a closing press conference, and he was asked about that. And he didn't say yes or no. He just ignored it. Now, we've since heard that he's recanted it, but then there are people that know him that say that he hasn't. So only two people in the government can tell a U.S. attorney to stand down. One is the president and one is the attorney general. The president was George Bush II, what some people would consider the cognitively challenged George Bush. And his attorney general was Alberto Gonzalez. Now, a U.S. attorney isn't going to cover up a nationwide pedophile network, go out on a limb and cover that up unless he's told to. He's going to have his bases covered. And an attorney general isn't going to go out on a limb and cover up a nationwide child trafficking network unless he's told to. So this order for Alexander Acosta to stand down had to have come from Bush, too.
And make sure that you join the Patreon to see that full interview where we talk about, obviously, more recent news. And we talk about some really interesting stuff about Mike Johnson, which I kind of found shocking, if I do say so myself. But we are bringing on our next guest, and I am so excited to be bringing her on. This is the first time that she's come on the show. So excited to have her. And she is Taylor Lorenz, journalist, and she's going to talk about this amazing story that she has in Wired, which we can throw up on the screen at some point shortly. So welcome to the show, Taylor.
Oh, thank you so much.
Of course, thanks for joining. So this story that you wrote at Wired has been getting a lot of buzz, and it's justifiably, because it's pretty astounding. It's one of those stories that's like, not surprising, but shocking that we actually have the evidence to prove the stuff that a lot of us have been thinking all along. And then there's another story on top of that story, which is the reaction to that, to your story. But before we get into that, just set up what this story shows and also how it started. Like, what made you write about it in the first place? To the extent that you can, obviously, because you can protect sources. Yeah.
Totally. So I actually have been reporting on Chorus for a while. Chorus is this group co-founded by the YouTuber Brian Tyler Cohen. They sort of came on my radar right after the election. Obviously, Kamala Harris lost. And there was finally this recognition from the Democrats that they needed to like embrace new media. And they kind of realized that they had a very failed media strategy and that she had failed to connect with voters. And so I was reporting on a lot of the like fallout from that. And I noticed this big splashy profile in the New York Times, of course, written by Ken Bensinger, who's an amazing reporter at the Times. And it was talking about, hey, we're here to fix this Democratic messaging problem. We're going to build this like, you know, network. And like, I mean, Chorus quite literally, the name is like all of these voices together in tandem, like boosting Democrat messaging. Da, da, da. That's how it was positioned. So it came onto my radar very quickly. And I started looking into them. I started following their website, et cetera, et cetera. Months later, I did a story about them where I reported on their fundraising decks, which somebody had sent me, where they had included a bunch of content content creators that actually didn't want anything to do with them, that had nothing to do with them, including Kat Abu-Ghazaleh and some others who were like, wait a minute, why am I being used to fundraise, you know, and get this organization millions of dollars potentially? I'm not even part of it. So I wrote about that. And then a couple months ago, people reached out to me and said like, hey, have you heard about this new funding scheme? And I heard from the creators involved with the program who had themselves problems with the program and wanted to speak out and kind of wanted more transparency and wanted this program to be known. So the program itself is basically like, I mean, what we write about is this dark money group, the 1630 Fund, is secretly kind of funding high profile Democratic influencers as part of this initiative. Influencers are getting up to $8,000 a month to promote the party line.
So there was a really, not surprisingly, very enthusiastic response to this. There is also a lot of upset, I would say, not surprisingly, in response to this. In fact, why don't we, before we get into that though, tell us more about the 1630 Fund, the dark money group behind Chorus.
Yeah, so the 1630 Fund emerged. It really became really powerful after Citizens United. So it's a sort of landmark decision back in, I think it was 2009 or 2010. And then a sort of a corollary decision that basically just gave birth to this massive dark money ecosystem that arose throughout the 2010s. Obviously, we're all familiar with Republican dark money groups, the Koch Network, et cetera. The Republicans hopped into the dark money ecosystem very early, leveraged it, you know, in regards to these influence campaigns very early. And Democrats are sort of sought to play catch up. So especially since 2018, in Trump's first presidency, the 1630 Fund has become this sort of like powerful, like liberal version of a lot of these conservative dark money groups. And Chorus is described in contracts that we viewed as a project of the 1630 Fund. So they're linked basically fiscally. And the goal is to, you know, the 1630 Fund is a liberal entity, and their goal is to push like, you know, Democrat type stuff.
Right. So let's take a look at one of the responses. One other question. Can you talk about the type of things that you looked at and that you had access to? Because I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously, I started by hearing from creators in this program. We talked to several creators in the program. We talked to people that were offered the deal. We got access to multiple copies of the contracts at different tiers of the program, recordings of an onboarding session, Zoom recordings, where the lawyer is actually quoted talking about how they don't need to worry about blah, blah, blah disclosure, things like that, which is in the article. And then we had screen recordings of group chats where the influencers are discussing the nature of the contract. We have emails between the company and the content creators themselves. We have an enormous amount of documentation and support for our story and the claims in it.
Right. So let's start let's look at some of the reactions. And the first one I want to look at was from Brian Tyler Cohen. Tell us who Brian Tyler Cohen is, his relationship to this, and then we're going to watch his reaction to your story.
Yeah, Brian Tyler Cohen is one of the co-founders of Chorus. So he is the ringleader. He's like the most prominent. He's the face of this program, basically.
Right. Okay. So let's take a look at this face and see what he has to say.
Loren says that the 1630 Fund is, quote, a powerful liberal dark money group. 1630 Fund is our fiscal sponsor. One of the largest documented donors to 1630 Fund is the same person funding Omidyar's Reporters in Residence program, which Taylor Lorenz herself is a part of. And guess what her monthly stipend is? $8,000 per month. So she's criticizing an entity that is funded by someone that she is currently taking money from. I guess it's okay when Taylor Lorenz gets paid, but no one else.
Wow, that's not true. Yeah. That's not accurate. Yeah, so what he's talking about... So first of all, we actually don't know that Pierre Omidyar is the biggest funder of the 1630 Fund. We don't know who funds the 1630 Fund. It could be foreign billionaires. We have no idea. The whole problem with dark money is that there's no disclosure. So sometimes billionaires that are interested in transparency like Pierre Omidyar will proactively disclose this information, or sometimes a journalist will figure it out. In this case, Pierre Omidyar, who's a billionaire who funds The Intercept, Honolulu Civil Beat, a bunch of journalistic endeavors, gave, I think it was like something like $40 million to 1630 Fund back in, I think it was like 2020 or 2021. that's irrelevant. He can give all he wants to the 1630 fund, just the way Lorraine Powell Jobs, you know, who owns the Atlantic, can give all the money she wants to dark money groups. That doesn't mean the Atlantic is somehow compromised. They're not receiving the money from dark money groups. So the Omidyar, you know, reporting fellowship that I'm under right now is completely funded by Pierre Omidyar. It has no dark money funding at all. And actually, because of this misinformation that people like Brian Tyler Cohen are spreading about this nonpartisan, non-political investigative journalism fellowship, they had to put out a whole press release saying, not only have we never received money from 1630 Fund, we have no financial connection to any, you know, dark money groups. But this is just such a gross mischaracterization. And it's also just absurd if you follow that logic out. It's like, is the implication that like I'm also somehow taking money from the 1630 fund, this dark money group that hates me? Like, and why would they be paying me to like report and write this like criticism, like this critical piece about their, like, what is it? What are, like, follow that logic and it makes no sense. But the whole thing is this intentional conflation with a political influence scheme and a nonprofit, or sorry, a nonpartisan, non-political investigative journalism fellowship. That is absurd. And I think it shows how much they do not respect journalism.
Yeah. And also, like, do they think we're that dumb that we're going to fall for something like that?
A lot of people on TikTok are that dumb, unfortunately, and do fall for this.
Maybe that's a fair point. But also, like, the point is the disclosure, right? I mean, you don't fact that you're getting this, that you're part of this fellowship.
They issued a press release the day that I was accepted and the day that they announced it. Not only did I post it on all my channels, but they issued a press release announcing my name and the other journalists who are some of the most amazing investigative journalists, you know, as part of this program. And also, the funding, you know, information, the reason they know about this program is because everything is out on the website. We didn't have to sign any non-disclosures. It's all public. The problem with Chorus and the 1630 Fund program is that none of it was public. None of it was disclosed. So that's, you know, aside from the funding, which is a very different funding structure, they also didn't disclose it proactively.
Right, which is a big part of the story. Let's take a look at another attempt made by Brian to discredit you. This one was creative and this is kind of typical though, but let's take a look.
It becomes clear who her efforts help when you hear stuff like this.
Genuinely, I kind of like Taylor Lorenz because I know that she actually believes what she says. Do you get what I'm saying?
So yeah, I generally don't align myself with friends of Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens.
Okay, so here he's saying that you are friends with Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens because they said something about you that they genuinely like you. Now, first of all, I didn't watch that full clip. But I have a feeling they would think you're kind of a nut job, right? When they say that you believe what you say.
They're making fun of the fact that I continue to acknowledge the ongoing COVID pandemic and the fact that our public health ecosystem is being dismantled. Like, I'm severely immunocompromised. And I've talked about how both political parties have fed the destruction of public health and how we need to take layered precautions, including getting vaccinated and wearing masks, again, to prevent the spread of airborne disease, including COVID. And they're like mocking me for that and being like, wow, she's so crazy, but at least she actually believes in COVID. Yeah. That's what
she's
they're mocking. Genuine,
right? She's giving you credit for being honest. I mean, they're giving you that. Yeah. But they think you're crazy.
Well, also, like, let me just be clear. I've reported on both of these figures extensively. Tucker Carlson engaged in such a public harassment and abuse campaign against me for years, to the point that my parents were swatted multiple times, had to leave their house in the middle of the night. Like, there are actual case studies. I think NYU did one, an Institute for Strategic Dialogue did another, but like the case studies of the vicious harassment that Tucker Carlson specifically has incited against me. So this idea, and I've never even met Candace Owens, you know, in person ever. This idea that like I am friends with either of these people, both of whom I've reported on critically for years, and who have incited harassment campaigns against me, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's also just ridiculous because, one, as you point out, it's like such a misleading, and I don't think anyone can watch that and actually think that you're chummy with them. But also, let's say, just for argument's sake, that you were. I mean, again, it's like a guilt by association that has no effect on whether or not you were telling the truth in your reporting. But obviously, that's why, he's doing this, because he's not dealing with the substance. So, tell us about David Pakman, and then we're going to watch a David Pakman response. But tell us about him and his relationship to this project.
Yeah, so David Pakman is also one of the content creators involved in this program. We found that he attended meetings for the highest tier paid, the highest paid tier of this program. He's a big liberal YouTuber, and yeah, he is involved in, you know, he's one of the content creators that attended these onboarding sessions for this program.
Okay, so let's take a look at what David Pakman had to say about this article.
All right, I was not even going to talk about this because I hate participating in the drama. I hate the circular firing squad that often builds on the left. But it's really important that my audience know what's going on. So I am going to talk about it. I was named in an article in Wired yesterday. And the article is about a so-called dark money group on the left called Chorus. And I'm named in the article along with other creators as being part of the group. And since this article came out, I've heard from a bunch of you. David, did you sell out? David, is the DNC telling you what to say? How could you do this to us? I knew back in 2021 when you had the following to say that you must have been getting paid by someone, and here's the proof. And I was not even going to give this the time of day, but my relationship with you, my actual audience, is the most important thing. And so I decided to do this segment. I also was told that other creators, like a Twitch streamer named Hassan Piker.
Wait, okay, like a Twitch, are you pretending you don't know who Hassan Piker is? Like a Twitch streamer, I believe, by the name of Hassan Piker. Like, come on, guys, you should have shown me drafts of these. I would have helped you improve these. Okay.
We're covering this in ways that don't reflect the reality of the situation and are perpetuating falsehoods about what is and isn't going on. Now, I can't speak to the motives of the people that wrote the article or those that are reacting to it. I can't get in their heads. All I can do is tell you what's going on, and then you can judge and you can make an assessment of me.
All right, so we're about to do that. But anything you want to tell him about or the audience about what your motives, what's in your heart, in your head? You know,
yeah,
thinks it's so mysterious.
I have reported I have a whole book that I wrote about the origins of the content creator industry, and in that book and in my reporting for years, I've reported on political influence schemes. So I would say 80% of the work that I do is covering Republicans, and I've covered the far right influencers extensively. But I've written a lot about the Democrats too and their various influencer efforts. So when I heard about this program, I thought, oh, wow, here's a high profile example of how the Democrats are seeking to influence the online ecosystem in light of Harris's loss.
Yeah, it's really not that surprising. It's not that doesn't require a lot of head scratching. But I get it. Again, this is an attempt at character assassination, right? Mm-hmm. Why do these people do this? It's the pseudo like respectful. I hate this passive aggressive pseudo respectful. Like, it's not my look. I'm not going to cast aspersions, and then I'm going to just like passive aggressively cast aspersions. Like, I don't know what's in their heads, like pathologizing you and Hassan Piker for writing it and Hassan Piker for commenting on it. But let's take a look. He has more to say in this very same video. He has more interesting things to say.
The idea behind this group is exactly what I've been advocating for years.
So he's talking about Chorus, right? The group Chorus.
Yeah, he's talking about Chorus, yeah. Right.
It's for years I've been saying the left needs to organize independent media in the way that the right has been doing. The left needs to fund independent creators the way that the right does. The right has won even arguably presidential elections because they're organized with regard to online and independent media. They're killing us. We've been so behind. And this kind of support for creators is exactly what I've been advocating for. Now, the article is riddled with inaccuracies, and they're not minor inaccuracies.
We can keep playing, but is there anything you want to say in response to that spiel before we go into the so-called inaccuracies?
Well, first of all, no one's arguing that content creators don't deserve support. Like, nobody's arguing that. My reporting is on like the specific, like the lack of disclosure and the funding, and we can get into all that. Right. But it's just like, no one's arguing that leftist creators need support. I know that better than anyone. I've literally written about that exact problem.
Yeah. Leftist creators don't, no one's arguing that they don't need support.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This group has nothing to do with the DNC.
So here's the mistakes, right? Here's that he's going to debunk your mistakes.
People writing saying the Democratic Party is telling people what to say. at its base, the group has nothing to do with the DNC, period. Number two, I do not.
And by the way, if you want me to pause, just go like that.
Well, I just, okay, yeah. Here's what I'll say. Yeah. Our article doesn't say anything about the DNC. The article doesn't allege any DNC connection. So it's great for him to debunk something that we never claimed right. in the article.
Yeah, yeah. David Pakman, how dare you say that Taylor Lorenz was the captain of her middle school basketball team? That's not true. I'm just...
It makes no sense. Okay. I know.
At its base, the group has nothing to do with the DNC, period. Number two, I do not get clearance for anything I say. I do not run interview questions by anyone at Chorus. I don't tell Chorus when I'm going to be doing an interview. Not a single segment I have done, not a single question I've ever asked a guest has anything to do with Chorus. They don't tell me what to talk about. They don't tell me who to interview. They don't tell me how to cover a story. There are no restrictions of any kind on my content.
Okay.
Okay.
I think like what he's doing is sort of like splitting hairs, because we actually don't allege anywhere in the story that they are told specifically to do things, or that they're given specific like talking points, or that like Chorus has like sort of universal veto over their content, et cetera. There is a clause that we reported on in the contract saying that they have to use Chorus Newsroom and that they're told to loop Chorus in on any outside engagements. If he's saying Chorus never enforced that, okay. But that is, we reported accurately on sort of what the contract stipulates, okay. And we can get into that later. But, this idea that like, well, Chorus never told us exactly what to say. We just joined this program that has a political agenda, and we do have to show up to daily messaging sessions. And there's some line, I think, also in the contract about sort of like promoting Chorus's policy agenda, something, Yes, they are not given explicit talking points, but I would argue, that there is some sort of goal to the program, and that if you were not broadly aligned with that goal, you would not be part of the program. So, that is not like explicit veto power necessarily, but so I just feel like he's refuting something that we don't allege again.
Right. Yeah. Which is, it's useful. If you don't know it, then it makes it sound like,
it makes it sound like we got it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But yeah. But also, you don't have to, Crystal Ball talks about this. Noam Chomsky talks about this. You don't have to necessarily tell people what to say because sometimes they are chosen precisely because of what they have to say. And we're going to get into that in a second. So let's actually take a look at, as someone who purports to be from the left, this is probably why Chorus doesn't need to tell him what to do, because he does stuff like this. Praises Richie Torres. So let's take a look at this clip of David Pakman talking to Richie Torres, who's, as Adam Johnson has reported on, he represents the poorest district in the country, in the Bronx, and he speaks about Gaza. He speaks about Israel with far more frequency than he does poverty. It's like a stunning statistic. I'll have to look that up, but it's more. Okay. Let's take a look.
Maybe to start with, I'm interested in your perspective right now on the progressive movement. And the reason I want to talk to you about this is I see you really, when people ask me, who do you see right now as the sort of progressive that you like to be at the head of this movement going forward? I think of you.
Okay, so that tells you a lot about David Pakman. So he thinks of Richie Torres when he thinks of the progressive movement going forward. And Brad, I'm going to send you this. If you could just put this on the screen, I'm going to text you something, which I think shows us a lot about who Richie Torres is. But Richie Torres, I mean, he actually was like made a lot of headlines this weekend, last week and this weekend, because he gave such a painful interview with Adam Friedland, just like came off as a total sociopath, a heartless liar, and his willingness to shill for Israel, his willingness to pinkwash it, his willingness to like go after, call out, like talk to other about other Jews as if they're not good Jews or they're not real Jews. Like he is some like honorary Jew dar ability.
So yeah, Richie Torres represents the poorest district in the U.S., but he mentions Israel 236% more than he mentions poverty. So that tells you a lot about Richie Torres. Here's another reason they probably don't have to tell David Pakman what to say, because David Pakman is someone who says stuff like this about Israel and Gaza.
Democratic countries who, if they make a mistake or lie, are subject to negative consequences, saying this wasn't Israel. They've released information, radar, audio, video. Internal assessments agree. This was not Israel. On the other hand, you have a terrorist authoritarian group with no checks and balances and no consequences for lying, saying it was Israel. And if you don't believe that there's no consequences to lying, there are still members of Congress who on Monday tweeted Israel killed 500 people at a Gaza hospital. Now that it's abundantly clear that it wasn't Israel, they have not deleted their tweets.
Okay, so that's from October 2023. He's accusing people of keeping tweets up. We now know that Israel not only bombed that hospital, but has bombed every hospital in Gaza. And yet he's kept this video up. It's on his Twitter page, his Twitter account. So that is pretty shocking. And I mean, I think that probably stands out. Like, if you're going to invite someone into this incubation hub, which is funny because he has millions of subs, it's probably, you know, there's a real like Brian Taylor Cohn also doesn't talk about Tyler Cohn also doesn't talk about Gaza. And David Pakman talks about it in a way that is so pro-Israel. I mean, I remember being shocked that anyone called themselves liberal who was his age and would talk about it that way. Like, I thought, like, just don't talk about it. I remember being shocked, but this is really embarrassing. And I don't think he's done a mea culpa on this issue.
I'm just disgusted by what he said. And when he's talking about like the terrorist authoritarian regime, I mean, that is Israel in this situation. So I don't even know what to say to that clip. It's appalling. This is why transparency is so important. Like, if these creators, and I know that Gaza has been like a big topic of conversation among this, like how many of these creators have spoken about Gaza? How many haven't? There are a couple creators that are saying, oh, well, look at here, I spoke about Gaza XYZ. Right. We don't know the full list of content creators in the Chorus program. The 1630 Fund and Chorus have not released that list. So we can't accurately judge the ideological makeup until we see that list. And so far, what we've seen is a bunch of creators, I think, that do share a certain agenda, ideology, or sort of viewpoint about the world are included in the program. And so we just have to speculate, in the meantime, because we just don't know. And that is why transparency is so important. We should know who all these creators are that received funding. We should know that they receive funding, how much. They should be transparent with that. And Chorus and the 1630 Fund should be transparent about what qualifications there are for getting into this program. You know, they need to talk about that and say, how did we evaluate this? And how did we decide who is going to get this money?
Yeah. Again, it's really interesting that no one really was talking about, I mean, not a lot of these people weren't talking about Chorus until your article came out.
Well, and now they'll say, well, Chorus was always public. Sure. Right. Again, Chorus was public. I wrote about Chorus. The New York Times wrote about Chorus. The point is that this funding scheme was not public. And that is what is newsworthy, is this undisclosed funding scheme.
Right. So I want to play another video from someone who's another, Chorus supported, Chorus content creator. Her name is Allie O'Brien. And she, I think, thought she was refuting your reporting, but you guys can take a look and see what you have to say. So this is a video that she posted August 29th.
Kicked out and essentially cut off financially if they even so much as acknowledged that they were part of the program or that Chorus existed. No. Here's a video of someone named Heidi who's in the cohort explaining what Chorus is and that she's joining it on November 20th, 2024. Here is
That's the public program. That's the public program. So she's, again, look, the people, the website, this is the public program. That's not the secret. That's never been the secret. It's the funding scheme that's the secret. And no one, since the article came out, I have said publicly so many times, show me one video where any of these creators, admitted that they were part of this, like disclosed that they were part of this funding scheme.
Right.
None of them did, because that's why my articles was a scoop.
Right.
None of them did.
In the contract I signed, there is some language that says, hey, please, like, before you make a public statement about what Chorus is, just check with us. The reason for that is that, as the article states, there's over 90 influencers in the program, many of whom have very small accounts and joined the program to get, like, mentorship and happen to be immigrants or trans in a red state, right? And, like, already happen to be kind of in extra danger right now. And so the goal with the, like, please check with us clause was to make sure that small creators who already had targets on their back weren't accidentally, like, featured on a huge page and then suddenly had an onslaught of threats from the right. Chorus has never been kept some
This is
so ridiculous because she's like, guys, it was never a secret. I just had to check with them because it was a secret. And it was a secret because actually trans small creators in red states. Who are these small trans creators in red states? They still have not been named. Like, what are you talking about? We're talking about Brian Tyler Cohen,
right.
David Pakman. These are some of the biggest names on YouTube. Lee McGowan, Politics Girl. Like, these are huge creators. Like, maybe there are some of these small creators in red states or whoever, whatever, that are receiving the smaller end of that scheme. I would argue, again, like, that is not an argument to participate in these non-disclosure schemes. Like, this just goes back to the thing that we saw on Threads where they're just like, well, actually, this program supports, like, Black women, whatever, even though the program is, as far as we can tell, overwhelmingly white. It's like, okay, so, but are you arguing that because of somebody's marginalized identity, they should be able to participate in, like, non-disclosure,
right. You
know, schemes? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And actually, it erodes trust because, we need to know who's in these programs. How many trans creators? Or were there any? Like, we don't know. We don't know how many white people. We don't know how many Black. We just don't know. Because it's not public. And so I just think it's crazy how she's like, guys, this was never a secret. And we could talk about it whenever we want. But actually, we were prevented from talking about it. And that's to protect the small, trans creators.
Right. Okay, let's keep watching.
Hey, this is already an unsafe job for some people. Check with us in advance so you don't accidentally, like, add to someone's unsafety. Okay, number two. According to copies of the contract viewed by Wired, creators in the program must funnel all bookings with lawmakers and political leaders through Chorus. No, again, I literally have the contract right here. I'll talk through it in a minute. But first, let me show you that.
If you go back a second, you can actually see what's above her head. Oh, wait, sorry. Go to where she pulls up the contract. Okay, so right there, above her head, while she's saying, guys, this is not what it claims. Please read what she says, what it says under book engagements. Chorus will provide contractors with access to the Chorus newsroom, which coordinates booking and engagement opportunities for creators. Da, 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 da. Contractor agrees to 1, use the Chorus newsroom to book engagements. 2, disclose to Chorus newsroom personnel any engagements with government officials or others on topics related to Chorus's policy agenda. What is Chorus's policy agenda? I asked them. They didn't get back to me. And 3, and basically it says, like, loop them in on these engagements.
Right.
So she's saying, like, it's crazy because she's like, guys, look, this isn't true. Here's the contract saying that it's true.
Right. Yeah. Okay. More... damning evidence against you, Taylor.
I literally have the contract right here. I'll talk through it in a minute. But first, let me show you this. Here's an email of me directly reaching out to the Zohran campaign to try to interview him. His Chorus does not control who I interview. Or what
Stop. This email is from June 2nd, before the program even began.
Okay.
By the way.
Wow.
So I just want to note that.
Nice. Post. I also sometimes text the comms directors directly of, like, Congress people that I want to interview, because usually the congressional offices will give out these little business cards. And this is not, like, specific to content creators. This is just, like, if you go to try to talk to your senator, their people will give you little business cards. I blurred out the name of the specific person because I feel awkward, but, like, anybody can get these business cards and then you can just text them. Chorus does not control that. I've done lots of congressional interviews and usually I just set them up myself. And here's the section of the contract, right, that confirms that. It says they want you to disclose to Chorus any engagement with government officials related to Chorus's policy agenda. That contractor, that's me, I'm the contractor.
Collaborate fully with Chorus means, regarding right, such separately engaged agreements. See the bottom that she's covering up? Collaborate fully with Chorus regarding all such separately arranged agreements. Sorry, just like she's negating her. Like that text literally negates what she's claiming. And she can argue that they never enforced it if she wants, but that is what the contract says. And we were reporting on the contract.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's not a defense. Like, you're not lying. If these people were able to not comply with parts of the contract, that doesn't mean that what you said is in the contract is not true.
Exactly.
Just arrange it myself with a congressperson. I just let Chorus know so that they know that congressperson's open to booking and other people in Chorus can do it too. Accidentally, I always forget to let Chorus know. Like, I don't think I've ever told them that before, but that's not what's important. What's important is that they're literally acknowledging here that you can book it yourself. And the fact that the person who wrote this article claims to have read through the entire contract, but like, here it is clearly written that what you stated in your article was categorically false. Like, that is quite concerning about your...
We never said that they couldn't book it themselves. It says right there that you have to loop them in.
Right.
And she's even acknowledging like, oops, I forgot to do that, knowing that she's supposed to do that because that's what it says right there.
Right. Did you write this script for her so someone could release her video claiming to do
I wish they would release their full contract.
Right.
They should post the full contract.
Journalistic integrity. Like, I get that these contracts are long and confusing. That's why people have lawyers and managers to help them, but you don't write an article about it unless you understand what's going on.
We had a lawyer review it, by the way. It was so reviewed by Lynn.
Also so condescending.
Article is just written like, you know, this group, they have money and so they control them. And it's just like, no, that's not what's happening. If there is someone in this cohort that you are like, they are too much of a shill doing whatever the Democratic Party says, it's not this program that's the reason for that. I don't know how to put this nicely. It's either a personal moral failing by those people or it's a different contract they're under that says they can't criticize Dems. But it's not this one because I'm under this contract and you can catch me on the...
We never said in the contract... We never said anywhere in the story that they're not allowed to criticize Democrats. Like, we don't even make that allegation at all.
Right. Someone keeps asking, what's that part that says no payments? I don't know what that is.
I can pull it up. Hold on a second. No. Oh, yeah. So this is a part where it's talking about Chorus funds cannot be used to basically pay to boost their content online. It's not relevant to any of what we're talking about.
Drew Cuomo, pissed at Cory Booker, calling for Chuck Schumer to lose his job. Take your pick. I have heard of contracts that exist that restrict what people can say bad about Democrats, but this is not one of them. This contract actually has no bearing on a single thing that we ever post, which brings me to my next section. The next part, and this is a really important part, I'm going to try to explain this as well as I can, but feel free to comment questions, is that the contracts reviewed by Wired prohibit standard partnership disclosures. What she's talking about, okay, a standard partnership disclosure is when you make a video in partnership with an org like the ACLU, and so then you put ACLU partner as a disclosure in your caption. There is very important context left out of this article of why the standard disclosures aren't the kind we use at Chorus. And that's because Chorus never pays us to make a video. The author of this article actually said that in a comment. You're correct that Chorus doesn't pay you to post specific content. Chorus is a training program where I learn things like what lights to buy if I want to film a YouTube video and what policy experts are saying about gerrymandering in Texas and National Guard in DC. So since Chorus is about,
you do learn about
personal
messaging.
Development and they're never paying you to make a video, of course you're not putting like Chorus partnership in your caption. That's not how that would work. So I don't fault anyone who read this sentence and was like, that is so evil, because a lot of people who consume content don't necessarily know the way that the logistics of like, you know, your partnership labels work. But I am frustrated at the author of this article for not adding like the relevant context here, because she is not supposed to publish an article unless it's been like very fact-checked and contextualized. And this was like very misleading. And then I also highlighted the section I accidentally talked about it.
Can I say something really quick?
Of course.
Okay. So first of all, she's so condescending. It's absurd. We never, like, yes, the point is, as I've said many times, they were never paid to post this specific, right? They were never given like, here is the copy that you must post and you must post it here. Because of that, and when you take this dark money, you don't have to disclose. We literally have a quote from their lawyer in the article on an onboarding Zoom meeting. Their own lawyer says there's some real great advantages to basically structuring this program this way. Quote, it gives us the ability to raise money from donors. It also, with this structure, avoids the public disclosure or public disclaimers, you know, paid for by blah, 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 that you see on political ads. We don't need to deal with any of that. Your names aren't showing up on like reports filed with the FEC. This is what their own lawyers are telling them. So yeah, you're right. You don't have to disclose it. You're right. You're not technically violating FEC laws, but I would argue that, like, or at least the many ethics experts who we called for comment, who are also quoted in the article, are saying that this is a deeply unethical agreement. And I think these are ethics experts that specifically study this topic.
Yeah. Oh my God. I hope she watches this so she can learn from the experts. Okay. Let's keep going.
Creators will not publicize the relationship with Chorus or tell others they're a member of the program without Chorus's prior express consent. This is the protecting small creators part, but also lots of things in contracts are written very strict in case of legal emergency. I've told plenty of people casually that I'm in Chorus and Chorus does not care. They've expressly told us that that's
Again,
fine.
This is that's just not the secret part.
Right.
That's not the secret part. Just want to reiterate that. Like, Chorus has always been public. The funding program is the part that's not public.
Right. It's like if I were telling you that I was like in a, I guess, a mentorship program, right? But I didn't tell you that I was also getting paid.
Yeah. Or like basically like I was part of some umbrella organization, but I didn't tell you that that umbrella organization is running this paid, you know, scheme with dark money ties that I'm in. Yeah. Like the money is the like, the part that's unreported. And these creators, it's interesting because I notice in all of their response videos, they sort of just skate by that. And I wonder if it's something that Chorus, like, you know, because they're putting out all a lot of the same messaging.
Right.
And we can get into that. But like, it is, they keep sort of trying to make this conflation in people's minds.
Right.
Chorus has to sue them and they can just be like, girl, the contract. Like, it makes it easier in court. They don't really care about it otherwise. It's not top secret. If you want more examples of people who've publicly talked about Chorus for a while, I'm happy to provide them. Feel free to comment. I just used Heidi's example because I think it's just very obvious. Okay, I have two more things to address in this video and then feel free to comment if you have more things you want me to explain. But the first is, we've talked a lot about what Chorus is not, because that article led people to believe that it was this, you know, a plot by the DNC to be able to just pay people off to blindly obey them. Now that that's been debunked, let's talk about what Chorus actually is. I have my Google calendar for the week here to explain. Every morning, we start off with a news update meeting. Okay, we meet for 15 minutes. I wake up and I'm immediately just told what the news of the day is. And we all get a chance to ask like questions if we want to know how a specific lawsuit is developing or what is Trump expected to do next with the National Guard, right? We're just making sure we're all the most informed. These are very brief. Sometimes they're 5 minutes. Then three times a week in the afternoon, we have a more like specific training. On Mondays, we have technical trainings. That's where we learn about a specific platform. So like someone will come and explain how you start a Substack or how you start YouTube long form. On Wednesdays, we have advocacy training, which is where we hear from an expert in a specific policy field. So recently, it's been a lot of people who work in like immigration explaining ICE or explaining the logistics of the National Guard, that kind of thing. And then Fridays are a little bit more flexible and they're optional. I haven't gone to them, so I like won't speak on it. And that is the weekly schedule. And the whole point of it is that you're like developing your channel over the course of 6 months so that hopefully by the end of it, you can be your own self-sufficient full-time content creator. Because people who work in politics on social media often have a hard time getting funding. Like it's hard to make it your job. But the right does a really good job of making it people's jobs, such that the political right actually pushes out 500 times as much content as the political left. That's an actual statistic every single day. They are outperforming us in volume incredibly because they just make sure that people can do it as a job. That's what this program is trying to accomplish to counter like the manosphere.
Can we just like back up on that? Everything that she just showed validates our reporting because we talk in the story about these, let me just find it exactly the language, but you know, we talk about these, here. Chorus creators are expected to attend regular advocacy trainings and daily messaging check-ins. Right. Those messaging check-ins are led by Brian Tyler Cohen of Rapid Response Days. But like, that is the point, is that they are attending these daily briefings, giving them a specific viewpoint or information rather on the news, which they use to shape their worldview. They're hearing from policy advocates that obviously have specific policy, like, and then they're like, oh, but I'm totally independent and they're just paying me because they want to support me.
Right. Right.
I just like, again, but it's just like, she's confirmed multiple points of our article by showing this, and she'll confirm it and be like, but guys, that's just this, or guys, it's just there because that's how legal contracts are, whatever. And it's like, okay, but then you're not refuting actually anything in our article.
Right. Just actually proving it. Okay. Let's keep going.
This country is like fundamentally broken. I want to talk a little bit about the logistics of dark money because it's not really explained in this article. Dark money is when someone does fundraising for the purpose of...
One other thing. The other thing is like, she just did the thing that Pac-Man did, which is basically like, yeah, we really need good creative support on the left, as if like that's the issue. Like as if your piece is saying, we shouldn't be making, first of all, a couple things. One is like, there's the left and there's liberals. Like Pac-Man is on the left. You know, they do a lot of left punching. I mean, this is a guy who literally praises Richie Torres as a progressive. He wants him to be the face of the progressive movement. So there's that. But again, it's very clever in some ways. They're like, I'm going to respond to this piece and say like, damn straight, I think that the left should be making media and we should be as effective as the right, which again, is neither here nor there. Okay.
influencing elections, right, like giving it to a campaign, through nonprofit organizations so that they don't have to disclose the identity of the original donor. So for example, right, we all know that Donald Trump is helping the Cuomo campaign in New York. Now, that's embarrassing for Andrew Cuomo is the problem. So if Trump wants to give money to the Cuomo campaign but doesn't want anyone to know it was him, he can give it to a dark money organization that again gives it to Cuomo and nobody can trace it back to Donald Trump. I don't like that system. And to be clear, most Americans don't. Like, except for the billionaires, we're pretty much all Republican and Democrat, like on the same page that that system is really bad. So I was excited to join this incubator program at Chorus for a while. It was the first of its kind on the left. I felt like it was really important for me as a leftist to be there. I mean, this way I can encourage people to be more critical of Israel, encouraging them to push their representatives a little bit harder. To me personally, I find it important to be in rooms with people who are less critical of the system than I am, because I have the hope of like nudging these people into more strong advocacy. And that's not always going to work, but sometimes it does. And so when the leaders of Chorus came to us and they were like, we're finally launching the program. We finally found someone to fund this. It's the 1630 Fund. I was like, ah, right. Okay. Not the biggest fan of their other work. Let me think on this. And obviously I ended up joining, but it was not without serious deliberation with my friends and my family and my management and the people who run Chorus. And ultimately, like, I want to sort of lay out for you who may be curious what my thought process looked like. I decided that my distaste for the fact that the 1630 Fund funds some, you know, congressional Democrat campaigns with methods that I don't like was outweighed by the potential benefit of a separate program where they have no control over what I say, where I'd be a leftist voice in a first of its kind incubator program for 90 people to combat the manosphere. I was like, you know what? This program is imperfect, but I think that I can do good from it. And I think that the threat of fascism is so big right now that there might need to be an order of operations, right? We need to get rid of the fascist threat of Donald Trump trying to take everything over. And then once me and us buddies are in power, then we get rid of the dark money mechanism so that nobody in the future has to do this through a dark money funder who's the only one willing to fund something in the future. I'm more than happy to have dialogue with people about, you know, the pros and cons and weighing like joining a program and whatnot. But I do want to like really emphasize everything I have posted has not changed at all since I joined this program. I think that's very evident.
Oh my God. Okay. I know that she just goes on. Here's the thing. If you caught that entire end part, she's talking about how she knowingly took dark money.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And didn't disclose it.
And, like, and she said because it's to fight fascism.
And of course. And of course, as soon as they get in power, they're totally right. Going to fix the system. Cause that's always how, you know, that's always how power goes.
Right.
You just need the, you know, it's very absurd, but I mean, listen, even if but you want to make that argument,
your point, right? The dark money point.
She's confirming the entire framing of our article, which is that this is a dark money funded program that was secret. Right. And then she's arguing why she took it. Again, you can make that argument sure. Why you took it, but what is your argument for not disclosing it? You don't have one other than like, well, if I talked about it, maybe somebody else would discover that there is a trans person in a red state that's also in my program. Okay, what are you even talking about?
Right.
Like, and I think it's also notable, Katie, that she even says, and we can talk about like, I mean, Allie got into the program. It's interesting that Allie ended up in this program because she didn't always have the best relationship with Chorus, but you know, she even notes that she is part of this cohort. Because she does talk about Palestine. She notes that she's part of this cohort of people that are, in her words, less critical of the system. And she was okay going right. into that because she said she felt like she could like move them on right. issues. Sure. It's just like, okay. So you admit that there is a, like, it seems like from what she's saying in that video, that there is a shared ideology among the majority of people in right. this cohort. And in her words, they are potentially less critical of the system. So
right.
That's I don't know.
The premise for her trying to influence them, right? Is that they are that.
Yeah. And we don't even talk about all of that in our story. So it's interesting to see her kind of like reveal these details of things that I think people suspected.
Right.
But it's all in this kind of like pseudo, like transparent way where if you don't know anything and you're coming into that video blind, you might think, oh, here's this person being transparent. But when you actually break it down, you see that video confirmed multiple points of our reporting.
Right. Yeah. It's very, I mean, it's well, I have to admit, like it's well done because it comes across, in my opinion, like it comes across as convincingly, like once I looked into it, I was like, oh no, there's nothing. This isn't just like at first I was like, oh, she seems like a nice person. She's not disingenuous. She's just confused. And then I realized, no, there's this is disingenuous. Yeah. So
very disingenuous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have some more. I mean, actually, before we have we can react to more people reacting to you, but I did want to bring something up because Nathan at Current Affairs, Nathan Robinson co-wrote a piece with John Ross called "Midas Touch Turns Democrats' Minds to Slop." Viewers are flocking to, quote, independent, unquote, media that serves up a never-ending stream of anti-Trump content, but this stuff is intellectual poison and may even help the right. But here's the relevant part, Brad. Could you play the, could you show that? Okay. According to Semaphore, Brian Tyler Cohen, and this is Tyler Cohen, of course, was involved in launching Good Influence, originally known as At Advocacy, a digital consulting firm which says it creates meaningful impact for causes and campaigns through our network of powerful online messengers. Former Vice President Kamala Harris has been one of the firm's top clients, as a search of Federal Elections Commission data shows that the Harris campaign spent more than $600,000 on digital consulting and licensing fees from Good Influence between July and November 2024. Good Influence has also received money from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and from Vote Save America, among other contributions. Good Influencer's founder, Stuart Perlmutter, has publicly documented visits to the White House alongside prominent liberal influencers such as Cohn, Pacman, Luke Beasley, and Lindy Lee, who has since left the Democratic Party and is now fundraising for Donald Trump. One of Good Influence's featured influencers, Kenny Walden, who goes by the name Too Raw, Too Real online, has taken his loyalty to the Democratic establishment to even more grotesque extremes, hurling vile misogynistic attacks at progressive lawmakers like Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He's
in the Chorus program too, by the way.
Oh, he is?
Mm-hmm.
He has also creepily taunted Bernie Sanders with images of caskets and a dead body, behavior that, far from being disavowed, has been rewarded with a visit to the Oval Office and insider status within the Democratic Party's influencer network. And in fact, yeah, we have a video of Too Raw, Too Real. Then I'll tell you a little something about Too Raw, Too Real and me. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks, and my upcoming documentary and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.